as they remain divided on key global issues, including the Ukraine war. Thank you for joining us. Our top story, Syria has denounced the illegal entry of a U.S. delegation into its territory as a flagrant violation of the country's sovereignty. Damascus says the trip of the delegation led by U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Ethan A. Goldrich amounts to a breach of international law and Security Council resolutions. The Syrian government has decried the delegation's meetings with U.S.-backed militant groups in northern Syria. Damascus says the claim that the visit is aimed at addressing the problems of the residents of Deir ez-Zor is a sheer lie and reflects Washington's hypocritical approach. Damascus says the U.S. plunders the wealth of the Syrian people and imposes unjust, illegitimate, and inhumane coercive measures on them. Iran's president says unilateralism in international relations is damaging the environment, criticizing developed countries for their lack of environmental concerns. Ebrahim Raisi said some developed countries put their industrial development before environmental issues, which harms the nature and the humanity. He added that hegemonic powers do not respect international resolutions on the environment. The Iranian president noted that political issues should not affect the principle of protecting the environment. Raisi was speaking at an international conference on combating sand and dust storms in the Iranian capital, Tehran. Iran says the US, the UK, and Israel are continuing their subversive plots against the country 45 years after supporting a deadly crackdown on the nation. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman says the recent public meeting in London between the Israeli intelligence minister and anti-Iran figures is clear proof of the relentless scheming. Iran has repeatedly blamed the US, the UK, and Israel for the deadly riots that broke out in the country last year. Nasser Kanani said the same, quote, sinister triangle supported the massacre on September 8, 1978 by the Pahlavi regime against an uprising which eventually led to the Islamic Revolution. The bloodshed in Tehran has come to be known as the Black Friday Massacre. A former head of Israel's spy agency Mossad has admitted that the regime is enforcing an apartheid system on the occupied West Bank. Tamer Pardo has warned that the greatest catastrophe awaits Israel as it is reaching a place similar to South Africa, a reference to an apartheid regime there.
A former head of Israel's Mossad spy agency has said the occupying entity enforces an apartheid system against Palestinians. The admission has been made by Tamir Pardo, who was the regime's spy master from 2011 to 2016.
Let's say there is a car accident between a car of a Jewish settler and a car of a Palestinian who lives in Hebron or Nablus. Each one of them stands before a different legal system, one under the military legal system and the other the civilian system. In a territory where two people are judged under two legal systems, that's an apartheid state.
Pardo becomes the latest former senior official to have concluded that Israel's treatment of Palestinians in the West Bank amounts to apartheid. That's a reference to the system of racial separation in South Africa that ended in 1994. Leading rights groups in Israel and abroad, as well as Palestinians, have accused Israeli occupation of the West Bank of morphing into an apartheid system. A handful of former Israeli leaders and diplomats have warned that Israel risks becoming an apartheid regime, but Pardo's language was even more blunt. Israel has been practicing an apartheid system against Palestinians, though far more brutally, since 1948. This is when, with the support of Western governments, Zionist terrorists claimed Palestine to be their homeland. Israel launched another war in 1967, occupying more Palestinian territory, such as the West Bank, including East al-Quds, that Palestinians want as as the capital of their future state. Since then, Israeli apartheid authorities have created a judicial system that allows them to steal more Palestinian homes and land and dispossess them in order to make way for more illegal settlers. Rights groups have pointed to the discriminatory policies within Israel and in occupied East Al-Quds, its blockade of the Gaza Strip, which has been ruled by the Hamas group since 2007, and its occupation of the West Bank.
Because the U.S. was the last pillar to fall, the last domino to fall in sustaining apartheid in South Africa, where it had to fall in line with everyone else. But during apartheid South Africa and the international campaign against it, during that regime's tenure, the United States issued the most vetoes within the Security Council to protect apartheid there, just to protect apartheid in Namibia and South Africa. And here we're seeing a similar pattern.
Well, this all comes as the United Nations has called for an investigation into the forced stripping of five Palestinian women by Israeli soldiers during a July raid on their home in the southern West Bank city of El Khalil. The move has also drawn condemnation from the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. Palestinian resistance groups have urged action against Israel's racist treatment of Palestinians.
Meanwhile, it has been revealed that Israeli female soldiers have forced Palestinian women to strip naked in front of their children during a night raid on their homes. The revelation has been made by the Israeli human rights organization Bet Salam. According to the report, soldiers threatened to unleash dogs on the families if the women did not comply. Regime forces broke into the Al-Luni family's house in the early morning of July 10. Two female troops took the 53-year-old mother, her 17-year-old daughter, and the mother's three daughter-in-laws, all in their 20s, into the children's room where they were forced to undress. The incident happened in the city of Al-Khalil. Well, the Organization of Islamic Cooperation has strongly condemned the move. The OIC urged international bodies to put pressure on Israel to end its daily breaches of human rights in Palestine and to take legal action with the appropriate international authorities. A coalition of Palestinian resistant factions has strongly condemned the use of attack dogs by female Israeli soldiers to force Palestinian women to strip naked, calling for a revolution in response to the regime's degrading behavior towards Palestinians. The United Nations has also called for an investigation into the forced stripping of Palestinian women by Israeli soldiers. Additionally, the UN Special Rapporteur on Human Rights in the Palestinian Territories, Francesca Albanese, has said that such incidents are absolutely appalling.
The United States is not just a bystander here. The United States is complicit and a pillar of Israeli apartheid in its provision on unequivocal financial, diplomatic, and military support. That but for that support, Israel could not sustain this regime.
Israel exerts overall control of the territory, maintains a two-tier legal system, and is building an expanding Jewish settlement. Furthermore, Israel has broken a 30-year record for the number of Palestinians unlawfully detained under the highly controversial administrative detention procedure. The practice allows Israeli authorities to detain Palestinians without charge or trial indefinitely. The number of administrative detainees is reaching 1,264, breaking the record of 1,108, which was set in March of 2003 during the Second Intifada.
Now, a powerful earthquake in Morocco leaves over 600 people dead and hundreds more injured. The 6.8 magnitude tremor struck the country's High Atlas mountains late Friday. The quake was felt as far as Portugal and Spain. The earthquake destroyed buildings and sent residents of major cities rushing from their homes. Many people spent the night outdoors fearing aftershocks and further tremors. The epicenter of the quake was the town of Ekil. Buildings have also collapsed in Marrakesh, the nearest major city to the epicenter. The United States Geological Survey says that the quake is the strongest to strike the region in more than a century. Leaders of the world's 20 largest economies, or G20, have kicked off a summit in the Indian capital amid divisions in the grouping over a number of global issues. In his opening remarks, the Indian Prime Minister announced that the African Union has formally joined the G20. The theme of this year's summit is One Earth, One Family, One Future. The leaders will focus on sustainable growth, trade and investments, security, among other issues. The agenda also includes more loans to developing nations by multilateral institutions and the impacts of geopolitics on food and energy security. But divisions among G20 members have cast a shadow over the two-day summit, as the leaders are divided over the Ukraine war. The Chinese and Russian presidents are absent from the gathering. Russia has sent its foreign minister, while China is being represented by its premier. Russia summons the ambassador of Armenia after the country announces plans to hold joint war games with the U.S. The Russian foreign ministry said in a statement that the drills on the Armenian territory are part of what it called a series of recent unfriendly steps by Yerevan. The ministry said those steps also include the trip to Kiev by the Armenian prime minister's wife amid Russia's war with Ukraine. Yerevan has also increased its criticism of Moscow's peacekeeping role in Nagorno-Karabakh. Armenia's prime minister recently said Russian forces have failed in their role to protect civilians and their freedom of movement in a key corridor in Azerbaijani-controlled areas in Karabakh. We were earlier joined by political analyst Rostam Savranov for his take on the ongoing row between Russia and Armenia.
Well, first of all, it's a long-term task of Washington try to separate former Soviet republics from Russia, to complicate their relations, to be able to create separate alliances which will exclude Russian Federation from processes in the Southern Caucasus. So that's what it's all about. Pashinyan, even it's upsetting to Russia, he cannot really find a good solution. He is like running around, he is like hunted down. He is in a very difficult position. Yes, they have a military defeat, but they want to save the minimum what they had. They want some guarantee for population of Karabakh, Armenian population over there. So, and he's trying to find a solution. That's why he's running to Americans. He's sending whatever his wife to Kyiv. All of these moves just demonstrate ability or disability to find any sort of resolution for that crisis, to find support wherever it's possible, since they feel Russia did not provide for them enough support to prevent that situation then.
A new strike by airline and airport personnel has caused widespread disruptions in Italy, with tens of flights delayed or cancelled. Max Civilli has the details from the Italian capital, Rome.
On Friday, a 24-hour national strike was called by a number of base unions representing airline personnel, airport workers, and ground handlers in Italy. As a result of the industrial action, over 100 domestic and international flights were cancelled, with great delays recorded in a number of airports, including those of Milan, Venice, and Verona. It was the 18th strike involving airport and airline personnel in Italy this year. Travelers are feeling that they are left bearing the brunt of the clash between aviation sector companies and their workers.
They are not able to find a mutually satisfying deal. It must be said that workers have been deprived of their social rights over the past years.
I'm from Madrid. I just got here. I don't know if I'll be able to reach my destination today. It's very annoying.
Aviation sector workers have gone berserk as airline fares have skyrocketed over the past year and their salary levels have remained the same, if not worsened.
Union's main demand concerns airport ground service workers' collective agreement covering wages. The latest contract expired 6.5 years ago. In the meantime, inflation has really eaten into wages.
In our airports, we've got insecure, low-paid jobs which push workers into poverty. Some employees are forced to accept part-time jobs for less than 800 euros a month. Some others have to pay for parking their car in the workplace car parking areas, let alone their undignifying working conditions. The logic behind this is the same as usual. Services offered at the cheapest rate. We have left the market in the hands of companies, and this is the result.
Goods and services prices in Italy have gone up dramatically since the start of the war in Ukraine. The 2022 annual inflation rate stood at over 8 percentage points, the highest level since 1985. Inflation stands at 6% today. A combination of high cost of living, skyrocketing costs of borrowing money, and insufficient fiscal support has caused a crunch that is felt at nearly every level in the country. Max Cibili, Rome.
Thank you for staying with us.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight.
Antarctica is often described as one of the most pristine places in the world, but it has a dirty secret. Reports say Antarctic research stations have polluted a pristine wilderness. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Nature wrote, historical bad practices have left a legacy of pollution, but efforts are on the way to chart a better future. Antarctica is often described as one of the most pristine places in the world, but it has a dirty secret. Parts of the sea floor near Australia's Casey Research Station are as polluted as the harbour in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil, according to a study published in PLOS One in August. The contamination is likely to be widespread across Antarctica's older research stations, says a study co-author Jonathan Stark, a marine ecologist at the Australian Antarctic Division in Hobart. He says, these contaminants accumulate over long time frames and don't just go away. Stark and his colleagues found high concentrations of hydrocarbons, compounds found in fuels, and heavy metals such as lead, copper, and zinc. Many of the samples were also loaded with polychlorinated by Henials, highly carcinogenic chemical compounds that were common before their international ban in 2001. When the researchers compared some of the samples with data from the World Harbor Project, an international collaboration that tracks large urban waterways, they found that lead, copper, and zinc levels in some cases were similar to those seen in parts of Sydney Harbor and Rio de Janeiro over the past two decades. The problem of pollution is not unique to KC Station, says Sisha Poirot, Manager of Policy, Environment and Safety at Antarctica, New Zealand in Christchurch. She says all national programs are dealing with this issue. At New Zealand's Scott Base, which is being redeveloped, contamination left from past fuel spills and poor waste management has been detected in soil and marine sediments. More of this historical pollution will emerge as the climate warms, says Poirot, adding, things that were once frozen in the soil are now becoming more mobile. Most of Antarctica's contamination is due to historically poor waste management. In the old days, waste was often just dumped a small distance from research stations, says Trent Palmer, a marine scientist at Texas A&M University Corpus Christi. Research stations started to get serious about cleaning up their act in 1991. In that year, an international agreement known as the Protocol on Environmental Protection to the Antarctic Treaty, or the Madrid Protocol, was adopted. This designated Antarctica as a natural reserve devoted to peace and science, and directed nations to monitor environmental impacts related to their activities. But much of the damage had already been done. Roughly two-thirds of Antarctic research stations were built before 1991. And although historical pollution is a problem, future pollution remains a concern as the icy continent becomes more crowded. There are already more than 100 research stations or national facilities, and most of the buildings are located in ice-free areas where they jostle with wildlife for a foothold on the most viable land. Ice-free areas make up less than 1% of Antarctica, but they support the highest diversity of plants and animals, including penguin and seal colonies. A 2019 study found that more than half of all ice-free areas on the coastline have ground disturbance that's visible from space. Sean Brooks, a conservation scientist at the Commonwealth Scientific and Industrial Research Organization in Hobart, who co-authored the study, said, "The stations have quite a large footprint for the number of people that are there. Each nation is responsible for its own environmental monitoring around research stations, and practices vary," says Brooks. He and his colleagues have proposed a solution in a preprint posted on the Social Science Research Network last month. They outline a 9-step process to help station managers set objectives for reducing the impact of their facilities on nearby ecosystems. Researchers are working on ways to reverse the damage of past practices. Lucas Martinez Alvarez, who specializes in bio remediation at the Argentine Antarctic Institute in Buenos Aires, and his colleagues are using bacteria to remove hydrocarbons from soil around Argentina's Carlini base on King George Island. In 2020, Martinez Alvarez and his team reported that they were able to remove more than 75% of hydrocarbons from fuel-contaminated soil. The approach could reduce the need to ship tons of contaminated soil out of Antarctica, says Martinez Alvarez. Stark says that the Australian Antarctic Division has already begun upgrading wastewater treatment facilities at its Casey and Davis stations. The next step for Stark and his colleagues is to assess whether historical pollution continues to affect Antarctic ecosystems today. Stark's earlier studies have shown that polluted areas in Antarctica are less biodiverse than control locations, with some resilient species becoming more dominant. Stark says it will be interesting to see if these effects have persisted or gotten worse, or if communities had adapted in any way.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. A former Mossad chief admits that the Israeli regime is enforcing an apartheid system in the occupied Palestinian territories. This comes against the backdrop of fresh round of violence by the Israeli military against Palestinians. The Israeli regime is also coming under increasing fire over its treatment of Palestinian women. The United Nations has demanded a probe into the forced stripping of five Palestinian women by Israeli soldiers during a raid in the occupied West Bank. Joining us on tonight's Spotlight, we have spokesperson of Masar Badil movement, Khalid Barakat, joining us from Vancouver. And also attorney, activist, and political analyst, Zakir Ahmad Mayet, joining us from Johannesburg.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Barakat in Vancouver. The Israeli regime has increased its deadly acts of aggression against the Palestinians, most notably since late December 2022. That's when the ultra-right-wing cabinet of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu assumed office. Just today, Israeli forces have again attacked anti-settlement protests across the occupied West Bank, leaving dozens of Palestinians injured. Give us your perspective on this heavy escalation by the Israelis.
Thank you for the invitation. Well, Israel is continuing its daily crimes with impunity, and particularly in the last few months with the current extreme right-wing government led by Israeli settlers. And we have been seeing that more and more Israeli crimes are being committed, especially during night raids. There's not one single day that passes without Israeli soldiers invading Palestinian towns, villages, refugee camps, and cities, including the reports that have been just printed by even Israeli media of how Israeli soldiers and Israeli woman soldiers attacked Palestinian families and forced Palestinian women to basically strip their clothes in front of their children and humiliate them, you know, and attack them with police dogs, threaten them with police dogs. These are daily crimes that it's happening in Palestine, across Palestine, particularly in the West Bank and Jerusalem. And the Palestinian resistance, this is one of the reasons why the Palestinian resistance is also escalating on the other hand. What we are witnessing in Palestine is an intensified, the conflict has been intensified, and we are going to witness more escalation from Israeli side and also more resistance from the Palestinian side.
Mr. Zakir Ahmad Mayet, the Israeli regime is facing growing criticism over its soldiers' forced stripping of five Palestinian women during a raid in the occupied West Bank in July. Give us your perspective on these insulting actions, which reportedly has become more prevalent as of late. The United Nations has demanded a probe into this practice, but it's the inaction of the likes of the UN, isn't it, that has led the Israelis to act in this manner and to believe that they are above the law.
A blank check has been given to Israel to commit atrocities against Palestinians, from daily humiliations at checkpoints to the establishment of new settlements stealing Palestinian land, to unilateral actions of administrative detention and executions on a daily basis. However, the dignity of women, particularly within Palestine and surrounding areas, is of paramount importance. And we have heard sporadic incidents of this over the many years. However, we see this as an intensified policy that has now been adopted under the ultra-orthodox right-wing government of Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich. And I think that Netanyahu is just a bystander trying to save his own skin from the judicial fire. That being said, the international community has created a situation where Israel's apartheid, Israel's mechanisms of oppression have been accepted. Hence, we see this escalation in the humiliation of the Palestinian people. And this is seen through all the allies that Israel seems to keep. We see a similar conduct taking place within India towards the Muslim communities there. We see exactly the same thing happening in Palestine. And this is because of, as you rightly say, the global community's inaction. The United Nations has mandated numerous probes into Israel, whether it was Operation Cast Lead 2008 to 2009. We know that at the moment in the International Criminal Court and the International Court of Justice, there are cases that are pending in front of them regarding Israel. And yet, till today, we haven't seen a single Israeli military official or political official behind bars or an indictment for them. However, you have an expedited system for individuals from Russia, for example, because of Ukraine, with clear double standards and the hypocrisy. Therefore, it comes as no surprise that our women are being subjected, our sisters are being subjected to this humiliation. However, the answer is coming on a daily basis from the resistance. There's retaliatory attacks on a daily basis, and this is causing havoc for the Israeli security establishment.
Right, Mr. Barakat, anger is boiling over regarding this issue as dozens of Jordanian lawmakers have now denounced Israel's forced stripping of the five Palestinian women during that raid that took place in the occupied West Bank. They are urging the expulsion of the Israeli ambassador to Amman and are calling on other parliaments around the world to take practical measures against the regime's crimes. Of course, collective action is a big step forward. Maybe this could set a precedent against future Israeli violations against Palestinians.
Yes, and in particularly in Jordan, as you know, the vast majority of the population in Jordan are Palestinians, more than 70%. And the entire population of Jordan, whether Jordanians or Palestinians, Palestine for them is the central issue. The regime of Jordan, however, is not just normalizing relationship with Israel, but also had signed a so-called peace agreement since 1994, the Wadi Araba agreement. And the regime is trying to release some of the pressure by allowing some kind of, statements that we have seen it before many, many times, whether from the parliament or whether from lawmakers. Now, these are good gestures, but it is expected more from the popular movement and the representatives of the people in Jordan to play a key role. And the demand is to end the relationship between Jordan and Israel, end any agreements between Egypt and Israel. And the unfortunate factor here is the role that the Palestinian Authority play in this whole scheme of normalization. The Palestinian Authority is basically a group of collaborators who works to secure their own BT interests at the expense of the Palestinian people. And they are now playing also a very dirty and dangerous game by trying to cover the Saudi regime moves in public normalization with the Zionist regime. And the Palestinian Authority is playing that role. And it's being exposed on a popular level. The Palestinian Authority and the Mahmoud Abbas have no legitimacy in Palestine. The Palestinian people are rejecting the PA policies, normalization policies. And in Jordan, particularly, because it has the longest borders with Palestine, previously Palestinians have carried military operation and they were shot by Jordanian regime army. Palestinians once, especially in the Shatat, in the diaspora, they want to participate in the armed struggle. They want to participate in the struggle to liberate Palestine. But these regimes are playing a reactionary role because of their alliance with the United States and with Israel, particularly right. In Egypt and Jordan.
Mr. Mayat, a former head of Israel's spy agency Mossad has admitted that the regime is enforcing an apartheid system on the occupied West Bank. Tamir Pardo warned that the greatest catastrophe awaits Israel as it's reaching a place similar to South Africa. That's, of course, a reference to the past apartheid regime there. Apartheid needs international action. So when will we see this international action? What more does the world need to see and hear?
I think you've answered your own question with the question itself. The international community has known that Israel is an apartheid state for some time. The statements of the former head of the Mossad, Tamir Pardo, recently has just been a nail that has been recognized the world around. South Africans, such as the late Archbishop Desmond Tutu, traveled to Palestine and observed the apartheid regime in action. Numerous South Africans that carry true gravitas have gone to the occupied territories, have gone to Israel proper, have gone to Gaza, and have said that the Israeli regime is practicing apartheid. So this is not something new. However, Tamir Paldo had written an article on the 16th of August for an organization. They refer to themselves as Security First, Commanders for the Security of Israel. And in that article, he says something very interesting, and this fits into a larger picture. He says that the caravan of Netanyahu has been hooked up with the Hariris, it's been hooked up with fascists, it's been hooked up with racists, anti-Zionists, ultra-nationalists. And this is very heavy language that comes out of the former head of the Mossad. Interestingly enough, it was Netanyahu who appointed him the head of the Mossad at that period of time. Further than that, we've heard another senior official, and this was in April of this year, Moshe Bogi Yalon, former defense minister, referring to Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich as people that want to bring about an apocalyptic messianic war. And he actually said that they are trying to implement the reverse Mein Kampf, which is referring to fascism, which is referring to Hitler, the book of Hitler. This is extremely heavy language from senior officials within the military establishment. Therefore, I think we've gone actually beyond the title of apartheid, because apartheid was already referred to by individuals like Tzipi Livni and Ehud Barak during the IDC Hezliya conference that they are slipping into an apartheid regime already 2015, 2016. We are talking about a fascist state. Israel has gone far beyond the apartheid regime. It's even worse than apartheid that was experienced here in South Africa. That's not my commentary. It's those individuals that have gone to Palestine from South Africa, who have fought in the resistance struggle here in South Africa against apartheid, and they have made this commentary. What we are looking at now, and if we look at the larger context from the seriousness of the individuals making these statements, is that Israel, they've read the writing on the wall. Israel is on its deathbed. They know this, that the only solution now is to try and throw Netanyahu under the proverbial bus and try and save what is left of Israel. That, for example, if Israel is rid of Netanyahu, Bezalel Smotrich, and Itamar Ben-Gvir, then it ceases to be an apartheid state. That's incorrect. It was established on the principles of racism. It was established on the principles of dispossession of the Palestinian people, and therefore the entire entity is foreign. However, the other issue is the disintegration of the Israeli military, number one. Number two is the strengthening position of the resistance surrounding Israel, and it is very clear that Israel has no future. Therefore, these officials have seen the writing on the wall, they recognize that Israel is on his deathbed, and they are now planning for the future, which is very similar, in my opinion, to that of South Africa, where we are talking about minority rights and a one-state solution, where the Palestinian people will dictate what the future will be and the formulation of government. I think that is where we are in the discourse now. It's no longer about Israel as an apartheid state, not about conscientization about Palestine. We all know these facts. It's about the death of Israel now. That's what we're talking about post the state of Israel.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Khaled Barakat, the right-wing government of Netanyahu is facing increased dissatisfaction and demonstrations from Israelis. The leader of the Hamas resistance movement, Ismail Haniyeh, has said in the past that the Israeli regime is in decline both on the military front and domestically. Is the regime now trying to divert attention and to reassert itself via the use of deadly force?
Yes, of course. Israel is trying to do everything in its power to exit the existentialist crisis that it entered. And it's going to be very hard to do that. And in my view, it's impossible. The Zionist regime have entered a stage of crisis that it's going to be very hard to come out from it. And Israel, of course, it possesses a very strong military and economic power, and it enjoys a very strong relationship with the United States and the Western powers that are keeping the Israeli project alive by funding it, by supporting it, but that's not going to help at all. Israel doesn't have any strategic depth in the region. It does not belong to the region. This settler colonialist colony state is collapsing despite its power, and the Palestinian people and the Arab people resistance is growing. Today in the region, we have two camps. One camp that it's led by the United States. And when I say the region, I mean, you know, the entire Arab homeland and West Asia. The one camp is led by the United States, Israel, and some Arab reactionary regimes. And the other camp is led by Iran and the resistance movement and the people movements in the region. This is today, these two camps today are in direct confrontation, and our camp, the resistance camp, is growing. It's gaining momentum. It's gaining a lot of popular support. Today, if you do polls in Palestine, Lebanon, Egypt, anywhere in the Arab world, the overwhelming majority of the people are with the resistance, and they see that Israel is defeatable. They saw that in 2006 in South Lebanon. They're seeing this in Gaza. And the Palestinian resistance is growing. This is a fact. Israel is recognizing this. Today, Israel is very careful of how it calculates its policies in the region. And we see that its internal front is collapsing. It's not united, and it's not just about secular and religious, you know, conflicts. We see Israel racist nature being exposed again, you know, when they carry not just their policies against the Palestinian people, but even against people from Africa who lives in Palestine. And Palestinians were always, you know, in support of those who needs a place and safety throughout the history of Palestine. But in the case of Israel, we see that they want to maintain a Western colony that is based, as Brother Zakir indicated, a colony that is completely, you know, similar to South Africa, where Zionists are ruling the entire land of Palestine and the entire region. And I think Israel is, we are witnessing the declining of the Zionist project to its end.
Mr. Ahmad Mayet, there was another act of aggression by Israeli regime forces against Al-Aqsa Mosque as they broke into one of the prayer halls at the holy site. Witnesses said that the Friday morning attack caused extensive damage to the prayer hall. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas has condemned the raid and called the attack a new crime, which is part of a religious war against Al-Aqsa and the city of Al-Quds itself. What do you believe are the motives of the Israelis by attacking and desecrating Al-Aqsa?
You have a right-wing government headed by individuals like Itamar Ben-Gvir and Bezalel Smotrich. If you look at Itamar Ben-Gvir, he's the same individual who represented the attackers of the Dawabshi family and argued for their release. He's the same individual that had a frame of the attacker, Baruch Goldstein, who massacred worshippers in the Ibrahimian Mosque. He had this man's photograph in his lounge. This is also confirmed by Moshe Bogi Yalon in his Hebrew interview. These are the types of individuals that are heading the government. It therefore comes as no surprise that you are seeing escalations within the most holy of sites, the Masjid al-Aqsa, Harem al-Sharif, and you see these consistent violations. You see the increase in the number of settler raids on the holy precinct, and you see this on a daily basis, protected by the Israeli police force. Yes, it is taking a religious dimension. Yes, I understand that we are heading in that direction. It is for that particular reason that the Islamic resistance movement, Al-Muqawam al-Islamiyya, has joined links and arms. They have a joint operations room, and they will exact revenge. There are certain red lines. I fully agree with my co-panelist that Israel is constrained. They have a few options on the table for them. Escalations at Masjid al-Aqsa, escalations within the West Bank, and yet we see with the Jenin operation, Operation Home and Garden, that they were not able to crush the resistance in Jenin. A handful of soldiers have overcome a larger group. All of that is praise to the Almighty. We cannot look at it in any other way. And this is indeed the death of the Israeli regime. It's the destruction of the Israeli regime. The military officials see the writing on the wall. Israel is tearing itself apart internally. They don't have a functional army any longer. The reserves are rejecting additional training and reporting for reserve duty. They are left with their standing army, which is not capable. And you even have rejections coming from inside Israel, such as the chief of staff, Herzi Halevi, standing in full opposition in his recent speech the last 2 days to the Netanyahu government. This is a complete position of chaos for Israel, and this is a boon for the resistance, and we will see the liberation of Palestine in our lifetime, God willing, inshallah.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Mr. Khaled Barakat, spokesperson of the Masar Badel movement, joining us from Vancouver, and thanks to Zakir Ahmad Mayat, attorney, activist, and political analyst, joining us from Johannesburg. A special thanks to you, our viewers, for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight. It's good night for now, and see you next time.
You have just listened to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 25 meters, 11,645 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Iran Sat or Bat 5 and Intel Sat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Answering your doubts and questions, and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Allah, who is Ar-Rahman? Allah, who is Al-Mannan? La ilaha illallah.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. Well, welcome to another episode of the program Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. I'm Atan, the host of this program. Sheikh Karimi is the guest speaker to answer my questions for today's discussion. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikh. Welcome to your show.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Okay, Sheikh Karimi, for today's discussion, we want to talk about the concept of ijtihad. And if the concept of ijtihad exists according to the Shia beliefs, what is the need at all to an imam or the teachings of a Shiite infallible imam?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. We know that ijtihad is somehow the highest level in terms of understanding the Islamic teachings related to the Islamic laws. And a person who reaches the level of ijtihad is called mujtahid, a jurist who is able to deduce the Islamic laws from these sources. So he knows, he needs to know different fields of Islamic studies like Quran and, Quranic studies, interpretation of the Quran, hadith studies, the Arabic grammar, and usul al-fiqh, and so on and so forth. So the point is that the sources of the Islamic laws from which the mujtahid is going to deduce the Islamic laws are three, or from one aspect four, that is the Quran, the Sunnah, that is the narrations of the Prophet and the infallible Imams, and the intellect and ijma' consensus, which somehow is an indication of the Sunnah. Anyway,
yes.
Now the point is that one of the sources of ijtihad is the narrations. So the question raised that there is no need to an imam because already we have the concept of ijtihad. But the point is that a mujtahid is able to deduce the Islamic laws not from nowhere. Yes. He needs to study the verses of the Quran, the narrations, and of course through his or her intellect. So without the narrations of the Ahlul Bayt alayhimu salam, the Imams, the Prophet, Lady Zahra salamullahi alayha, a mujtahid is not able to deduce the Islamic laws. Even when it comes to Ahl Sunnah, although they do not believe in the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt as we Shia believe, they are not also able to deduce the Islamic laws.
Yes.
If you want to limit yourself to the Quran, then you may have only less than, 500 Islamic laws.
500 ahkami laws, yeah. That's right. Yes.
But all the details are mentioned in the narrations. So our Sunni brothers, the Sunni scholars, they refer to the narrations of the Prophet, and then the companions of the Prophet, the Sahaba, and then Tabi'un.
Yes.
Those people who met the companions, but they did not see the Prophet.
That's right.
And even with all these narrations, we see that the Sunni scholars, because they do not have access to the narrations of the Imams, in some cases they were forced to go to some other ways and methods for deducing the laws, like qiyas, like what they call it istihsan, or al-masalih al-mursala.
Yes.
So all these points refer to the fact that without the narrations of the Imams of the Ahlul Bayt, ijtihad
has no meaning,
yes, and will not bring any fruit.
And this imam that we are talking about is the infallible imam,
exactly.
Imam al-Masumi, because Sunnis have their own imams too.
Yeah, their understanding of imam is different. For deducing the laws, they refer to the Quran, the narrations of the Prophet, okay. Sahaba, Tabi'un.
Yes. Yes.
And for some of them, for example, the Hanafi school, yes, of jurisprudence, they refer to Qiyas, and some of them Istihsan, Al-Masalih Al-Mursala. And they called the leaders of those four schools mm-hmm. as imam.
Yes.
And, of course, they used yes. the term imam for other scholars as well, for example.
And now the question is that, do our Sunni brethren have the concept of ijtihad or mujtahid or not?
No.
Not at all.
I mean, it's different from our understanding of ijtihad.
They have the word ijtihad or mujtahid?
No.
No, they do not have it.
Even if they have, they do not mean what we Shia mean by the word ijtihad.
Okay.
Because the concept of ijtihad in Shia understanding...